another badly used item of modern technology. The advice to managers: one man, any machine maintained by one man, will have a long, happy lifetime. Any machine maintained by two or three or four or five will have a short, troubled, sad life. Get the right microphones to begin with. Assign it to one person and let him always take care of it. You'll have no trouble with microphones. Now, if you're on the other end, points here are pretty much clear. The main thing about microphones is that you want to avoid surprises. So you find out before you get involved in your talk what the microphone's going to do. You learn there are different kinds of microphones. Some pick up only from the front. Some pick up from all sides. They're called omnidirectional. Some have a heart-shaped pattern of pickup. They're called cardioid mics. So if you experiment a little bit, you'll see how the mic, you don't have to determine precisely what kind of mic it is, but determine how you have to stand and speak so that it will pick you up. Some of them have an abrupt fall off. They'll pick up well anywhere from 1 to 6 inches, and at 6.5 inches, you won't hear a thing. So find out what the mic's going to do to you. If someone's in charge of the sound system, then he's an invaluable person because he'll know everything to do to make it work nicely. If you want it up, you want it down. Locate that person if he exists. Learn how to turn the sound off. The reason is because once something, one of these things starts squealing and squawking and pounding and doing everything and buzzing, it may never stop. And the only way to deal with it may be just to cut it off and speak loud. So it's a good thing to know how to shut the thing off. Dodging and weaving. I have one godbrother in mind who does this. He sort of dodges and weaves with the mic. So you get a sort of in and out and in and out, half a sentence and the other. It drives you nuts. So don't be a dodger and weaver. Keep a uniform, reasonably uniform distance from the microphone. The last point is perhaps the most important. Well, I'll make this overall statement. Microphones in their present state of technology are sufficiently sophisticated that they can create a loud yet intimate atmosphere when properly used. And that's what they should do. They should allow your audience to feel that you're talking to each one of them individually. It shouldn't be that sitting in the audience I feel like I'm getting blasted out or otherwise tortured. So when you set up a microphone system or when you use a microphone system, that should be the aim, that you're having a one-to-one talk with your audience. India is notorious. They just take the microphone, see how high it can go, set it to that, and leave it at that. And the result is kind of, it's just misery. People have to shut it off or turn it down in their minds, which they quickly learn how to do, or else they just go away. So learn how to set it at a good level and keep it there. If you're in charge of setting it up, use multiple speakers rather than one real loud one. Tirupati is the only place I know in all of India where I saw that they use microphones and speakers intelligently. They, as you travel up the hill to see the deity, they have microphones that broadcast lectures and bhajans and what have you. But they're all set so that when you come within a short range of them, you hear them at a pleasant level. And when you go out of a short distance, you don't hear them at all. It's wonderful. And they have a lot of them, so you're always hearing it at a pleasant level. It's wonderful. So much better than three real loud speakers that cover the whole place. Okay, that's it for mics. Any questions? And one more
question. Number 10, Maharaj.
Yes.
What does number 10 mean?
Don't be the great voice that doesn't need a mic. It means that if a microphone is really required, Don't try and bluff it. Don't try and pretend that you can, that your voice is so loud that you can reach everybody. Don't be. In other words, it's machismo. Avoid machismo. Okay, you know what it is. Is it? Even the British know what it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
And number 11.
No one is not needed. In a situation like this, you can all hear me. So why do I need a microphone? Microphones, generally speaking, put more distance between you and your audience. They work against intimacy and individual contact. So whenever you can easily do it without a microphone, prefer to do it. There's no reason why you have to sit in Soho Street Temple with a microphone to be heard. Unless it's Dwadasi and you fasted all day the previous day and you really don't have it in you. But otherwise, if you've got 10 or 12 people in your audience, just ask them to come a little closer and speak at a normal, pleasant voice. And it's so much more rapport will build than if you have that machine and it's inevitable hum. There's a certain amount of hum in any, even the best microphone system. So much better voice to voice if you can do it. But if it's not tenable, don't try and bluff it. That's the point. Okay? Good. Fallacies. You have hasty generalizations from a couple days ago. So sometimes someone attacks an argument by saying, that's just a generalization. But there's nothing wrong with something being a generalization. A generalization might be true. A generalization is simply a statement about a large class of things or items. Finding it? Hasty generalizations? I'll give you another moment or something. It was page 20 of Straight Thinking. Yeah, you got it yesterday. Keeping you a day ahead. So generalizations, that something's a generalization doesn't make it wrong. That insects have six legs is a generalization. It's also true. So just to say that if someone says, if you say something, oh, Bengalis tend to be shorter and lighter than Punjabis, and your poser says, well, that's just a generalization. Then what do you respond? Respond, so? That doesn't make it untrue, so? It's a generalization. What else do you have to say? Okay. So, the trouble with generalizations is that they tend to be overbroad, they tend to be reckless. We make a statement that we can't back up. Because all it takes to prove that a generalization is false is one exception. One exception. If I say all swans are white, and suddenly a black swan flies by, that's it. Doesn't matter that the other 99,000 swans in the universe are white. The one black swan is enough to prove that my generalization is untrue. We dealt with this earlier under the everybody knows category. Because everybody knows that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. If there's even one person who doesn't know that, the generalization is false. And I can be that one person. Prahlad.
Can you say most?
Yes.
That would be correct.
Yes, it's how much easier it is to defend most swans are white. Because even if they come up with 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 or a whole zoo full of them that are black or tangerine colored, you can still say, well, most of them are white. Yes?
I'm noticing a lot of the mistakes that you mentioned are like mistakes of impetuousness or passion.
Yes. Yeah. They're impetuousness, passion, sloppy thinking, not discriminating carefully. We just toss out a remark without editing it, without refining it, without sifting it. So, or we know what we mean, but we don't say what we mean precisely enough to make it a defensible statement. Or what we mean is also not thought out clearly enough to be legitimate. In other words, it's not only sloppy out in the ether, it's sloppy inside too. We have all these really sloppy ideas, conclusions that aren't true or aren't justified because we haven't thought them through carefully.
Also, at least in my experience, I know when I'm being passionate, when I'm in a discussion, I know when I'm not really all the way there, understanding the shell of platform. I can just sense that. In deep waters, even, I don't really know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you get into these troubles by snap, by speaking too quickly. I personally prefer writing because I have the tendency to speak impetuously. I like to write because when you write, you can really tailor what you say so that your argument is solid. It's going to be like a fortress that no one can penetrate. When you speak, it's a lot harder. You really have to be on your toes. Writing is easy in a sense.
Writing will really train you for better speaking.
Pardon?
Writing will train you for better speaking.
Writing will train you for better speaking. Better speaking will train you for better writing also. But yes, if you learn to write well and write carefully and argue carefully in writing, it'll certainly help you in speaking carefully and arguing well verbally, orally. Yes?
How will writing practice you will make you someone that speak concisely better?
Pardon me?
Okay. How will writing make one more
make
precise?
It makes you choose your words more carefully. A good writer chooses his words with precision. So does a good speaker. And he thinks about what he writes. So does a good speaker. Now, another trouble you get into with generalizations is that you say something in which the word all is implied, even if you don't say it. For example, if you say swans are white, that's really the same as saying all swans are white. If you say blacks are less intelligent, that's the same as saying all blacks are less intelligent. Then you've got to defend that statement. If you say women are less intelligent, and some woman comes back and says, do you mean all women are less intelligent than all men? Then that's what you've said, that's what you've got to defend. And if she comes up with even one super smart woman and one super dumb man, you're in trouble. You've made a generalization that's going to be extremely hard to defend. Okay?
Can you see your statement and add that in general?
In general, what? Yeah.
Swans are
generally white.
All white in general.
Yeah. There are all sorts of qualifiers you can use. Women tend to be less intelligent than men. Most women are less intelligent than men. In my experience, women are generally. There are all sorts of qualifiers you can use. On the whole, generally, tend to be, for the most part. Yeah, you can use all sorts of qualifiers. A caution here, though, don't let it make you mealy-mouthed. It seems to me that in general, in most cases, anyone who doesn't surrender to Krishna tends to be demoniac. That's pretty pea-soupish. just come right out and say that Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, if you don't surrender to me, you're a demon. That's got strength. And for the most part, people generally who don't surrender to Krishna or who are reluctant to surrender to Krishna are probably influenced by the tendency to become demons. You qualify yourself right out of any sort of impact. You might as well throw pillow feathers at the guy.
Yes? This type of thing is due to a lack of faith in Krishna consciousness or lack of strong realization?
It may be due to lack of faith, it may be due to lack of strong realization, it may be due to lack of guts, or it may be due to just a bad habit to water down all your statements about anything. Cultivate guts. Be bold. Charlemagne. I mentioned it earlier. Charlemagne said, fortune favors the bold. It's on his flag or something. Yes?
And when you preach that, some devotees, they use the term, we believe, saying we believe in reincarnation, or we believe the soul is...
Well, it's another way. No one can argue with you. When you say, we believe that the moon is made of green cheese, no one can prove that you're wrong. Because if you say you believe it, that's it, you believe it.
But I mean, isn't it, this using of believing makes our station weak?
Yes, it does. Our standard way of putting such an argument is, according to the Vedic literature, or the Bhagavad Gita says, which is also an irrefutable statement, as long as you've quoted the book correctly, then no one can prove you wrong. And then, in fact, for example, if you say, everyone who doesn't surrender to Krishna is a demon, then people can challenge you. If you say, according to Bhagavad Gita, everyone who doesn't surrender to Krishna is a demon, it's much more difficult to challenge you. They have to prove that it's not in the book. Now, they may disagree with what the Bhagavad Gita says, but at least your original assertion that this is what the Bhagavad Gita teaches is established. And even if they come back and say, well, I know some perfectly nice people who happen to be against Krishna consciousness, but, you know, they're very nice. Say, well, Prabhu, I'm sorry, that's what the book says. If they don't surrender to Krishna, they're demonic. It's not my fault. That's what Krishna says. I'm just telling you what Krishna says. You can accept it or not. See what strong ground you're on? On the other hand, when you say, well, we believe that people who don't surrender, well, why do you believe that? Then you have to retreat back to where you were, where you should have been anyway, and say, well, because Krishna says so. Everyone's got beliefs. Beliefs change, beliefs are... Srila Prabhupada didn't go for it. Yes?
Maharaj, I was told that Kalakanta, the Lord of Bhutan, said that to never use belief. And he says, I mean, that when you're going to speak, you can use something like... I experience, it's more like a personal thing. Something you did, or you see, or you...
Well, that's also valuable. I'm not going to lay down a law that no one can ever say, I believe. Because there may be some particular instance in which we believe might be the most tactful and thoughtful thing to say. But generally speaking, you're better off avoiding we believe, I believe. Yes.
I believe that I heard Srila Prabhupada use we believe in certain circumstances.
Yeah, in certain circumstances, Prabhupada may rarely use it. Just like I think, which is a statement that used to be commonly known, that Srila Prabhupada said, before you begin a statement with I think, begin it in the closet. I think, I believe, in my opinion, this language is very much beloved of the mundane scholars. Because in the scholarly world, everyone's idea is as good as everybody else's. Everyone's entitled to his own beliefs, his own theories, his own speculations. And just that you believe it makes it wonderful. But in Krishna consciousness, we don't go that way. We go by authority. So Krishna says, Vedic literature teaches, or just come right out and say it.
Yes? Now, when you say Vedic literature teaches,
teaches and you make a direct statement like that, that you obviously know someone's going to disagree with, are you responsible to have to verify the validity of the Bible that he's based on?
Well, it's understood that you may have to do that. Just ask your question again, because I had a double thought in mind.
If you make a statement like that, that you know people are going to disagree with, that comes directly from one of our literatures, do you have to prove the validity of the literature?
That's more or less understood. If you're speaking to an audience that doesn't accept Bhagavad Gita, and you say, according to Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you may place yourself in the position of having to defend the validity of Bhagavad Gita or the validity of the statement. You can go either way. They say, well, why should I accept that? You can do two things. You can either show that it's a reasonable statement, or you can show that Bhagavad Gita ought to be accepted. You have both options open. One advantage of this approach is that it puts you in such a reasonable position. You're not really telling people that they're demons. You're not really telling people that life is meant for self-realization. You're not really telling people that they ought to chant Hare Krishna. You're not really telling people that they should give up mental speculation and sense gratification. All you're really doing is telling them what the Vedic literature teaches. It's a great thing to do in university classes or any academic setting where you're not supposed to be preaching to people and getting them to, trying to convert them to a particular point of view. You just come in and make sure that every six or eight sentences you say, according to the Vedic literature, according to the viewpoint of the Vedic culture, the Vedic tradition teaches. You keep throwing those in every few minutes to make sure that you're not really saying that they should surrender to Krishna or do any of these other things. You're just coming there to enlighten them about what the Vedic tradition is all about. And in the course of doing that, you get your whole viewpoint in there. It's really a great way to do it. In fact, you can do this with anything. I was reading some book where someone was... It's called quotation marks. It's a game called quotation marks. You can tell anyone anything as long as you put it in quotation marks. For example, you say, you know, I was speaking to somebody the other day who said that as far as he could ever understand, all women are less intelligent. And he went on to say that so on and so on and so on. And as long as you put it in quotation marks, it's not what you're saying, it's just what somebody happened to be saying. You don't have to take responsibility for the statement. You can go on and on and on like that. There was somebody who was giving a seminar. Anyway, someone was giving a seminar, and these people were all real dull. And the guy wanted to let them know that they were dull, so he started telling a story about some farmer who had a lot of birds. And then the other farmer came along and said something, and then he said something else, and then he said something else, and finally said, he said to the birds, you're all just, you know, birds, you're all just, like, if you were standing in front of a doctor's convention, and the punchline of what the man said to these birds was, you're all quacks. You're quacks, that's what you are. And then the farmer repeated it. He said, every single one of you is a quack. But because it was in quotation marks, it was quite all right. So I'm sorry I didn't get the example 100% right, but it was along those lines. The idea is that as long as something's in quotation marks, it can be as strong as you like, and you can say it with impunity. That's the idea. Okay. Yes?
Can you ask something about that? I mean, if people understand what you're saying, they're going to be offended and reject what you're saying.
I know that, but it's sort of a way of putting it across. As long as you put it in quotation marks. So Prabhupada would do this. He'd say something strong as anything. Then afterwards the person would object. And Prabhupada would say, it is not my saying, it is Krishna's saying. What can I do? Yes.
Also, isn't there that understanding there that if they do object to it, they're automatically putting the shoe on them? Then if they just kind of let it work on their conscience a little bit.
I don't understand this thing about shoes and feet.
Well, he automatically makes himself guilty of being the one that the person was talking about.
Yeah, you can always say, listen, I was just telling a story about farmers and birds and everything. I don't know why you took it so personally.
In San Diego, we had a design technique of having a survey to sell books. And we
first question, are you a vegetarian, or whatever they say, where you mark it down. And the second question, are you aware of the fact that the American Medical Association has concluded that meat eating is the major cause of heart disease and colon cancer? And whatever they answer, they kind of agree with it. And sometimes they say, I don't agree with that. And I said, well, that's not the question. Are you aware of the fact? And it was like, because I was asking it from a survey point, it was like, I was aloof from it, so they couldn't attack me.
Right, you're not advocating it. Are you aware that the Surgeon General says that smoking is absolutely, under all circumstances, detrimental to your health? It doesn't say that you're against smoking, or even that you believe that it's against health. But it might as well, you've made your point clear and where you stand clear. But it's all in quotation marks. Now, one thing about generalizations, don't make them stronger than you need to. Otherwise, you're going to have to retreat. A person who's expert about carefully limiting his arguments, is our Sariputta Prabhu. He comes out with a statement, and it's a statement that's precisely what he means, and precisely what he's prepared to defend, and not an inch more. And therefore, when someone attacks him on something other than what he said, he's on the safest ground. I'll give you an example. In the World Congress, he gave his paper, and then there was someone assigned to respond to it, who in this case was my favorite guy at the conference, a real booze-swigging, meat-eating carmi from, I forget which university, UCLA, if I remember. And Sariputta said, gave his argument, and then the man said, now I was following your argument pretty well there. The trouble was that all of a sudden, God suddenly just popped in there. And I didn't really understand exactly what God had to do with what you're talking about. And aside from that, I don't think it's mathematically possible for anyone to prove the existence of God, which seems to me what you're trying to do here. And I'd like to know how you respond to that. Because you haven't offered sufficient mathematical proof to satisfy me that God exists, and I don't even think it's possible. So Sariputta came back and just answered and said, I tend to agree that it's not mathematically possible to prove the existence of God. Therefore, what I was trying to demonstrate in my paper wasn't that point at all, but rather to show that mathematical theories can be formulated in such a way that they need not be inconsistent, as most present theories are, with the existence of God. That it's perfectly possible to formulate the mathematics of such and such and such and such, just as easy to do it in a manner consistent with God's existence as inconsistent. And that's what I was attempting to demonstrate. And the man had no alternative but to back off. Because Sariputta had completely demonstrated what he set out to demonstrate. And that was the end of it. So he chose ground on which he knew he'd be strong. And then he stood on it, and then he defended it against all comers. And he never had to backtrack and say, well, perhaps that's a little stronger than what I meant. What I really meant was. So carefully limit your argument. So it's something that you're really prepared to defend under all circumstances. Make your generalizations defensible, impenetrable, and stick by them. Okay? One last point is that this question about all and some is one that's dealt with very well in the second chapter of Straight and Crooked Thinking. So if you'd like to find out more about that, look in there. Okay. Hasty generalizations. Using microphones. Fights. A lot of people are absent today, right, John? Not my imagination.
There are about 10 people out today.
Wow.
Is there few classes that were canceled
today? Oh, maybe because Dhamma Krishna Maharaj's class was canceled. Oh, and some of them may have gone on a program. Okay. Good, I understand. Yeah?
Earlier, a couple of weeks ago, the idea came up about how to ask the correct question.
Yeah, I'm going to deal with questions. How to ask, or how to answer questions.
How to ask you questions.
All right, let's take that on right now since you brought it up. Answering questions I have a full class about, but you want to say something about asking questions? Go ahead.
So much time is wasted trying to sit through these unthought out, kind of like a cook. He just has his ingredients laid out over the table and doesn't really have to prep ready. And he tells him it's like, we have to just wait till he just puts it all together in his head and has to come out of his mouth in all sorts of crazy ways until anyone figures out that question. You know, it's like, the ingredients are in his mind, but he really doesn't know how to formulate the question.
So you're not asking about answering questions. You're asking about answering
questions.
To ask the question, it's very simple. Get your thoughts straight and don't open your mouth till you've got them. It's really embarrassing to open your mouth and launch out on a journey and then find out that you haven't a clear destination and have no idea of where you're going. There's some quotation that those who start out going nowhere generally get there.
Yeah.
So if you start out with unclear, unformulated thoughts, and then express them in their unclear, unformulated thought form, you're likely to communicate merely that you're unclear and unformulated in what's going on in your mind. And beyond that, not much. Just think, wait, get it together, and speak. Now, how to deal with a person who's putting out all sorts of, well, it's kind of like, I mean, what I mean to say is, you know, I met this person yesterday and it kind of reminded me of, in our class on questions, I'll tackle that. Okay. It's not a waste of time, and I'll move that class up maybe. It's coming in the next couple of days. We have a little time for a fight, yeah. The topic is, I don't believe in religion. As long as what you do makes you happy, and as long as you don't hurt anyone, da 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 da. So we'll take two sides for that. We'll do it here. We don't have so many devotees.
The reason I don't believe in religion is because I see no tangible benefits of people who practice religion. I see that the practice of religion historically has been the cause of great social conflict. I also see in many countries of the world, poor countries, large amounts of national financial resources are poured into building churches and publishing religious materials when that money could be, in my opinion, far better spent on housing for poor people.
That's a very good point. We feel the same way. That over the course of history, religions have kind of misled people because it wasn't really religion according to our definition. Our definition is that religion, even the word itself, re means to go back, legere means to bind. So religion means a process that is meant to bind one back to Godhead. And the Srimad Bhagavatam explains that religions that are tainted materially, material motivations, there is Srimad Bhagavatam, which is called Spotless Purana, rejects these religions that are materially tainted. So what we advocate is not the type of religion you're speaking about, that materially motivated religions, but real religion, which is Sanatana Dharma, or acting in one's constitutional position with God. You believe in God, don't you?
As far as I'm not sure if I believe in God. I don't believe in organized religion. I see, for example, all over America, here in India, it's a very poor country, you're spending millions of dollars on opulent temples and churches, which are just outside the temple. There are poor people, beggars, living. I would see that money far better spent, far more spent, if it was spent on those people.
Is Srila Prabhupada, founder of our movement on religion, stated very emphatically that in order to practice this religion doesn't really require any huge buildings or opulent temples, like you're saying. You could just as well practice just sitting under a tree, chanting God's holy name. But he also stated, too, that people of this age, they are kind of attracted to nice places, aesthetically pleasing. And it's not just the building itself, but what goes on inside that makes a difference. There are so many expensive churches, mosques, synagogues all over the world. A lot of them they're not used very much. If you come to one of our temples, they're always filled. There's chanting going on from 4:30 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night. So the money we feel is well used.
That's all very well good. I still maintain that if you take the example of Jesus, I mean, certainly in humanitarian terms, I agree with a lot of his practices. He lived very simply. As far as I know, he didn't build any churches. He simply wandered among people. Whatever food and money he had, he shared among people. And I see that, you know, religion may start off with ideals, but people following it later on, they become perverted. And they start spending money on all kinds of unnecessary institutional items.
Will you come? I just happen to be a temple manager. If you like, you could come and watch our activities for as long as you like, a weekend, a week, a month if you like, and see how we spend our money, how so little money is wasted, how it's being used in the direct service of God. And what you said before, you made a comment about being against organized religions. You might be happy to know our religion isn't very well organized.
There's no shortage of religious books in the world. I don't think for a minute Bhagavad Gita offers any insight that the Bible doesn't, or the Quran, or any of these other books.
Srimad Bhagavatam explains, there's a nice verse where it said that the supreme occupation for all humanity is that by which men can attain to pure love and devotional service to God. And that service should be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. So, our movements explain that very nicely to people all over the world. In order to be happy, one must learn how to love God, uninterrupted and unmotivated. The religions you mentioned before, they're largely motivated. For one reason or another, people are following a religion for some type of material benefit. But here we're explaining unmotivated. The only motivation is to learn how to love God, to revive your loving relationship with God, and uninterrupted. These people right here, they're not just coming to the temple Sunday morning.
I'm going to blow the whistle here a bit, and let's digest what we've got so far. Some comments? Yes.
I like how Adhiraj started off strong with giving the original meaning of the word religion, and he clarified between what the person he was arguing with about the understanding the person had of what religion was, or how far he believed in God. Clarified then. But then he got a little bit weak in not distinguishing that what this man's point was about people going hungry. I think if he had spent more time on prasadam distribution and state of Srila Prabhupada made about within 10 miles, how much you're going to get.
I want to address that last point in a moment. But first, let's focus it on your first point. Immediately, he gets the argument on his own terms. What do you mean by religion? Partha says, I don't believe in religion. Religion doesn't help anyone. And Adhiraj immediately says, well, first, better than anything, Adhiraj immediately disarms him. So I agree. All those big heavy blows suddenly go right into the pillow. I agree. You know, religion stinks. It's really terrible. The things that go on in the name of religion, it's just awful. So he completely disarms him by saying something with which his opposer has to agree. Adhiraj is particularly distinguished by his affable nature, by his soft and winning manner of speech. Now, I wouldn't deal with Partha at all this way. I don't have these gifts of Adhiraj. I'd immediately take Partha on with my prickly nature and you know, his temperature would rise at least 4 degrees, mine would rise 5 or 6, and his would go up 2 more. But Adiraj has such a wonderful, charming nature that he immediately says something sympathetic. Yeah, I agree, it's just really terrible what goes on in the name of religion. And then, having disarmed him, he's completely ready to bring forward his own definition of what religion is and begin preaching right out of the Bhagavatam. First, he preaches a little Latin, and after a little Latin, he's ready to go straight into Sanskrit. It's not much of a jump, is it? Other points. There was another technique that Adiraj used right at the beginning. Yes?
He made a friend, and he was touching him.
I didn't notice that, but if he did, that can be very good. One thing about touching people, you sort of have to see whether it's all right. In some cultures or in some circumstances, touching someone is an offensive act. In India, for example, you don't make friends with people, usually, by touching them. Except that as a foreigner, you may get away with it. One Indian person doesn't make a friend with another Indian person by touching. It's just not part of the culture. But if, as a foreigner, if you're someone like Kirtiraj, you may just put your arm around the guy. You put your arm around Mr. Agarwal and say, "Listen, Mr. Agarwal, you know, that's all right." And you just transcend all the cultural rules, and you can do it because you're a foreigner. Just as Prabhupada, he would argue so strongly with someone, and then later he'd explain that I can get away with that because I'm an old man. But you can't argue that way. Okay? But in America, you can, or in Europe, you can do that. You can touch someone and establish a certain rapport that way. That's not what I was thinking about, though. Any other things that he did? Yes?
He pointed out that religion didn't have to be materially motivated.
No, I have something else in mind. Yes?
When he did touch Bharata Prabhu, immediately he gendered some humor there because he said that we're not an organized religion.
I noticed that one. Humor he used to such good advantage. Anyway, you'll be very happy to see that we're totally disorganized. Again, he's just pulling off all that armor. And he's getting down to the nice, soft, sweet core of Partha. Another thing. I'll point it out. Every time he asked a question, he just gained ground. You believe in God, don't you? Immediately, although Partha was starting on the offensive, it seems to me this, that. Adiraj, although taking such a humble and mild-mannered stance, actually took the offensive with his sweet little innocent question. You believe in God, don't you? Then Partha's actually on the defensive. He has to say either that he does believe in God and wait for Adiraj to come back with, well then, in that case, you should also accept this and this and this. Or else he's got to explain why he doesn't believe in God. So Adiraj again has taken a strong place. And later when he says, religion is a process to understand God. How much stronger is his position when he says, religion is a process to understand God. Don't you agree? One leaves him just with having said something and leaving it open for Partha to say whatever he wants. But when he ends, don't you agree? He's taking control of that argument. Now Partha's got to say either that he agrees, yes, more and more I agree with what you're saying, or no, I don't agree, and here's why. And then he's on the defensive. So these were all strong techniques used within the context of a most unassuming and humble way of dealing. It was very effective. Some other points?
Not agreeing, you're taking defensive.
Excuse me?
If you're not agreeing with what, like if you ask him, well, you believe in God, don't you? He says, well, yes. But then he's going to come back with some more argument. He says, well, the fact that I believe in God doesn't mean that I have to.
That's right. Partha can take the offensive then again. Partha can take the offensive. Adiraj has directed the argument and said, you believe in God, don't you? So Partha, being a sort of pious fellow, is caught off guard a little bit. But he can take it the other way. He said, no, I don't believe in God. You mean you believe in God? What's your evidence that there's God? This God idea has caused as much trouble as organized religion has. He can take the offensive that way. Or he can take the offensive this way. He can say, sure, I believe in God. So what? What does that have to do with the argument? Nothing. My point was, he can take control again, but he didn't. Yes?
On that question, Parther responded what I thought nicely. He said, whether there is God or not, that's secondary. The fact of the matter is religion is not providing for the poor people.
Right.
So that was another...
So he took control of it very well. He pointed out that this is not what we're talking about. I was busy writing something down, so I missed how adroitly he dealt with it. But yeah, he just tosses it aside and says, that's not what we're talking about, is it? And notice that is it, at the end, puts it on him. Well, I guess you're right, it's not what we're talking about. Notice the effectiveness of ending with questions. As long as you're not opening up the opportunity for your opponent to give a speech on his favorite topic, questions can be extremely effective. Another point?
Yeah, I think he used a circular argument when he was proving the Bhagavad Gita by taking from Srimad Bhagavatam.
To prove Bhagavad Gita from Srimad Bhagavatam is not circular. To prove Bhagavatam from Bhagavatam is circular. But to prove Bhagavad Gita from Srimad Bhagavatam when the person doesn't accept Vedic literature is pretty close to being circular. Really what you're doing is you're quoting Vedic literature to prove Vedic literature, and that is circular. Now, to get to that point that was brought up earlier, that Adiraj was skirting Partha's argument. The essence of the argument that Partha finally retreated to or focused in on was that people have so many needs. They have empty bellies and sore bodies, and religion doesn't do anything to meet these real needs. Instead, it's busy up in church spending money on gold ceilings and such things as that. Now, what are you really doing for the people? Nothing. That's what we've seen. Now, you can look at that argument. And Adiraj responded to that in various ways. He responded by talking about our Food for Life program and so on. He also responded by talking about our transcendental literature. Ikshaku thought he didn't stress enough how we really were doing the things that Partha was talking about. Until he started talking about transcendental literature, I was going to point out the opposite. Because there's been a tendency of late to respond to this argument in that way. When people say that you're not really doing enough for the material needs of people, we drag out our lists of endorsements of all the good things that we really are doing for people's bodies and minds. That's one way of dealing with it. It's not the usual way Prabhupada dealt with it. The usual way that Prabhupada dealt with it was by pointing out that his opponent was barking up the wrong tree. That the person was putting all the emphasis on the material body, when in fact the body is not the self. That in fact, both the people that he was talking about, and he himself, were an illusion, being on the bodily concept of life. And Prabhupada would focus right in on that bodily concept of life, which is the essence of what illusion is all about. We've tended in recent days and years to back off from that kind of approach. We don't like to make people feel bad by pointing these illusions out. Rather, we prefer to agree that these material benefits really are a very important thing that anyone who's really concerned about people should be taking care of. And that our movement is a good movement because it's taking care of these things too. Prabhupada would use both arguments. It's a fact. Prabhupada would sometimes point out how we are feeding people and we're doing this. But the fact is that Prabhupada would prefer, in the vast majority of cases, to go right on the point that you don't know what real welfare work is. And you give the example of the person saving the drowning man's coat.
Sure.
So I thought that Adiraj initially handled it with a fair amount of cowardice, but later redeemed himself, in my eyes, which are not the ultimate eyes, but in my eyes, he redeemed himself, by stressing that we were doing the real welfare work, which Partha and his cohorts had neglected. Any comments or feedback on that? Yes, Janik.
I wrote down here in my notes, it seemed that he waited too long to pull out
That's what I thought. I would have liked to see him go right to it and say, well, yes, it's a fact that this is going on, but in fact there's a higher welfare work that you might not be aware of. I agree that to help people by filling their bellies and so on, maybe, of course I wouldn't agree, but if he agrees, that's his kind of nature. I agree, but there's a much higher welfare work that you're just missing here. And then go right to the point that you're not this body. Maybe yes.
Well, it's just that I heard a class Prabhupada gave, and he was speaking to a man, like, to a very similar part, the argument. And that drowning man, he said 15 times.
15 times?
15 times. I counted them. I think 12 or 15, until the man understood. And that was about 35 minutes or something.
If you want to see how Prabhupada typically dealt with these things, read in Science of Self-Realization Prabhupada's answer to the man from the Andhra Pradesh Relief Fund Committee. Is it there in SSR? Is it not there? How someone wrote in from the Andhra Pradesh Relief Fund. No, I guess it's not there. It was too heavy. That's right. They didn't put it in. There was a letter published in Back to Godhead. Some man wrote in, head of the Andhra Pradesh Relief Fund, that it's a pitiful situation in Andhra Pradesh. There's been drought for 4 consecutive years. The cattle are starving. People are dying. He just painted this pitiful picture. And he just pleaded with Prabhupada that if you could kindly mention in your Pandal programs, which are being attended by 10,000 people a night, if you could kindly mention our humble attempts and ask people to contribute some small sum, then this would be a great service to humanity. And Prabhupada wrote back, Dear Mr. Such and Such, I've received your letter, such and such date. I've noted on your letterhead the names of so many respectable men, but I have to inform you, and the gist of it was, that you're all wasting your time, that all these respectable men are wasting their time and money. There have been so many attempts to help people materially and it hasn't done anything. It's all addressed to the body, which in fact you're not. In fact, if these people would spend their hard-earned money and their good endeavors for spreading the Sankirtan movement, they could really do welfare for humanity. That grains, that starvation means no grains. Grains come from rain and rain comes from yajna. So really you should get behind yajna and stop this mundane attempt. Prabhupada was merciless, materially speaking, with the man. He just flayed him. If you get a chance to find it in old BTG. It is an SSR. So read that, how Prabhupada dealt with it, and preach like that.
He took it out of the Swedish version.
I remember when I first read, I understood all the rest, but this part I never understood.
This is a sadhu. He cuts. He says strong, he gives strong words that people may not at first understand. He doesn't chicken out. And later people may come to understand. But he doesn't spare the point. He doesn't compromise. Prabhupada used to be criticized by his godbrothers for having a chopping approach to preaching. Prabhupada would say, it may be chopping or whatever you say, but that is my duty.
In fact, I think a lot of people understand this point. Because, you explain about the different sufferings.
Yeah.
And that there's so many organizations in the world, at least somebody has to look to this point.
That's right.
There's so many welfare organizations. And I found that, yes, they can accept that.
Not only this point, but in general, the rule would be that when you stick up for your point, when you stick by your guns, you win. That is, don't compromise. Don't be like the man who lost his caste and was still hungry. Don't be so eager to agree with everybody that you wind up having nothing to say except what he's already saying. You're not necessary for that. You become redundant. You might as well retire. You're out there to do a job, which is to say something different from what everybody else is saying. If they don't accept it, too bad. That's our job, is to say something that not everyone will accept. Any popular movement, anything that's really done something in the world, has done so, not anything, but almost everything, has gotten that way by saying something that people generally won't agree with. The communists, the American revolutionaries, all these people who carried big causes did it by speaking strongly in such a way that a lot of people would disagree with them. And a lot of people on the other side would agree with them. So they polarize things. They make the argument plain, they draw the line, they ask you to choose sides, and they fight for their side. Rather than just buddy-buddying, you know, those people who buddy-buddied with the British on the American side. You know, they didn't end up anywhere. They lost their farms and they lost everything. Don't mind. You know, they got seen as being just tepid. You know, you were afraid to speak out. You were there playing both sides against the middle, trying to be friends with everybody by agreeing with everybody about everything. And you ultimately, you were nobody. You were gutless. When the Nazis were in power, the people who were just after seeing that everything was smooth for their own interests, and who therefore agreed, yeah, I guess it's not so bad that this and that and the other thing. Afterward, they wound up in front of tribunals for going along with things they shouldn't have gone along with. So don't go along with causes and arguments that you don't agree with. If something's against our philosophy, say so. If we don't agree, say so. If it's on the bodily platform, say so. If it's nonsense, say so. Strong speaking. Straight thinking, back it up with good arguments, good reasons, and speak strongly. We're just about ending because time's up. Yes?
Prabhupada was asked about his preaching, and he once said that his preaching was like karate. He gets the pressure point and pushes until they die.
I never heard that. It doesn't sound like Prabhupada. But he said that? Karate.
Is it like, I don't know,
pressure points?
No, there's another example I'm thinking of the wolf going for the throat.
Oh.
And not letting go.
That sounds more like Prabhupada. I never heard Prabhupada talk about pressure points. There's a doubtful story. If you bring it to me where it's from, we'll talk about it. That may be. But anyway, if you look at Prabhupada's argument, that was his way of doing it. Find their weak point. And the weak point's not hard to find. It's always the same. Maya's consistent. So just keep going at it. Tomorrow we'll talk about proof by selected instances, which is something that was indulged in a lot right here in this argument. Proof by selected instances. I'm sorry we didn't get chance to talk about it today. We'll definitely talk about it tomorrow. Hare Krishna.